it's grateful to have poetry. Yeah. Okay. If you do, you want to read another one? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds good. I might read from my friend Charlotte Guest's book Soap. Charlotte's undertaking a PhD in creative writing very soon. This one's called The Seagull, and it reminds me of the one I read by Cassandra Atherton in a way, in the literary references throughout it. At university, I studied a bad poem, bad in the opinion of T.S. Eliot. The images don't build upon each other in a meaningful way, he wrote, and there is no continuity of thought. He had similar theories about the canon. Each work added should rearrange those that precede it. The poem we studied progresses through the parts of a ship, charting the visions of someone drowning, until suddenly a seagull splices the lines and drops heavily onto its internal harmonies, clanging like a bung chord. "Fucking bird, the brazenness of it," said Eliot, as if a good poem resists the accidents of moments or ignores the fact we are not at peace inside. As if a good poem is only symmetry, only grace and music, defining itself against the day's apparel. As if a seagull would not split a man's sight of the ship from which he fell. As if it would wait for the man to go under. As if it would care. As if the bird cares for poetry that cannot be flown through.
Yeah. I read another poem by Ranjit.
Yeah.
So earlier I gave you a poem that was not a prose poem but had some narrative, and then I also gave you a short story which might have been a prose poem, but I think this is a prose poem. Palace. We were brought by stealth through spiked gates and sunken courtyards to the Queen's favourite palace. He was a grandmaster whose head she had once saved from the block by wrapping her brocade shawl around the executioner's axe. The ruse had not been entirely successful, but by degrees she had restored the dead man to health, feeding him a mash of basil leaves while the harem slaves dressed his wounds in poultices. She had given him a sinecure now, as she does to keep him busy every summer when she must repaint his head in turmeric and coal. He mapped the treacherous dunelands that shift ground behind the palace. They whisper as they shift, like courtiers, through the afternoons while the guardsmen doze beneath their canopies. The Queen thinks this will occupy her favourite through the day. In the evenings, he forgets the burden of air that his shoulders carry when he sits with his palace librarians, who have gone blind through their minute scrutiny of the palm leaf manuscripts that have come down to them in undeciphered script. Now they no longer read, but measure the hours in delicate quanta of opium. The poppy is their only talisman against an ironic custom that obliges them to wear the spectacles which were the insignia of their office. They have mumbled the same chant over and over for 40 years, trying to recall the one spell that works the rain. They fidget with the polished betel nuts secreted in their cummerbunds. Their milkstone eyes crinkle from habit. They leave nothing to chance, cling to mnemonic belief in miracles. That is all we know of what happens on the terrace where the librarians huddle around a fire in the icy desert darkness. Through mute gondoliers are reported to sweep it with nightlong oars. The gardeners never talk about the fallen waves that they shear away every morning. These routines have never been breached, so the grandmaster cannot believe it when rasping thunder interrupts, for the first time in 40 years, the lull and drone of the recitation. For the first time, these eunuch mounds taste anthill dust on their rolled praises of lightning and fall open. In the moment that they fall open, a peacock cries out and is heard for miles, even in mud-baked hamlets where no one knows that the king has been dead 40 years and they still worship him in effigy.
Yeah, that's beautifully read. I'm like hearing you read it and looking at the page and how the lines go to the end, it made me think of something that Jen Crawford said in an article about prose poetry, that that verse poetry has a kind of an extra trick up its sleeve in the, with the delineation. They have a pause before the final, like the final line, and I guess it's interesting to me that she calls it like the final prop before the curtain call, that you have that. And I think of it as a little bit like the pause before you deliver the punchline of a joke. You've got that like build up, whereas prose poetry can't rely on that. It's all delivered quite evenly. And
yeah. There's a lovely word in Hindi which comes from Sanskrit called tahara, and it means to like pause and to take a breath in which you sit with this sort of sense of satisfaction, and then it goes on. And so people talk about this sensation, a break in the traffic, but also when you're watching a dance performance, or even when you just kind of like, you know, I don't want to get too much like a beer ad in Australia, but there might be a resonance there when you like crack open the VB at the end of the day on a hot summer's day, and it's like that moment of pause which is like truly satisfying. Okay, so that might be like it's cultural transposition here.
Yeah.
But maybe we should turn it over to questions from
sure.
our audience.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I don't know if I misheard you earlier, but I think you said that a lot of your poems, you actually start writing them out formatted as prose, and you actually find that quite helpful. Is that, if I got that right? Or
yeah, that. Yeah. I write in prose originally. I'm not sure if I've always done that, but I do it now. And
right.
I don't know why that is. Maybe it's because it's kind of like a first draft.
And
then sometimes I'll chop it up. Yeah. And I don't know why it is that sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. Sometimes it stays as a prose poem. Yeah.
And you're not so much like that.
No, I construct my writing in lots of different ways.
Right.
Because partly the method depends on what I want the reader to experience. So if I want, say, a Sharon fragmented sense, which where the form or the content might be to give that sense of fragmentation, then I make my method quite fragmented. But sometimes I sit down and it will flow because I want it to be easy reading. And so I want the method to sit with the content, to sit with the form in that sense of flow. But it really depends on what kind of mode I'm working in and have done previously. And sometimes it works, but I try to like have a harmony between the method and the kind of content and the form as well in a way to create.
It's almost as much how it looks in your head as how it sounds in your head.
That's right. And I think where poets and short story writers and novelists and journalists are probably quite similar, is I think people have conscious and unconscious writing rituals. And that might be lining all your pencils up on the desk. It might be lighting the incense. It might be putting the whale music on. It might be getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning. There's lots. Or having a cup of coffee. I think people have conscious and unconscious things that are similar to rituals to help you get in the mood of your writing. And I think that kind of matters as a kind of structuring device for the process. Yeah. Other questions? Hey, Joseph.
There's been a lot of talk about voice in the short story and the importance of it. What happens to voice in
Robbie?
I think this is an interesting question, and this is partly why we bring up this question of experimental poetry too, because I think of there's critical conversations around voice for non-experimental poetry, and like one of the things that seems to define experimental poetry is a lack of engagement with voice. But I think of voice as a really fundamental and important aspect of poetry, and not only poetry that is centered around the speaking I. You know, so we often think of voice and saying I this, I that, but I think you can work in a number of different voices. What I do think that's got a relationship to short story writing too, because we're thinking of voice and perspective and third person and first person, and what voice can we give this poem? Because you could have a short story where you're speaking the voice of the dog, and you can have a poem where you're speaking the voice of the dog. But I think poetry is really well developed in its critical sensibility about what voice is. And I think there's lots of things that we think about when we think about poetic voice, and there's a rich critical discourse around that, even in vernacular demonic conversations about amongst other poets, it's like, what's the voice? And I think in that way, the voice is not only the one you have when you order milk, but it's a persona you have within your poetry. And you go to poetry readings, and there might be an upward inflection at the end of the line as a common vocal tendency. But I think it's important to have a consciousness of voice so you can play with it too and make it enjoyable and accessible and beautiful.
Yeah, I read that prose is polyphonic and dialogic, whereas poetry is more solipsistic and monologic. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing it right. And it's really interesting to think of prose as being many voiced, and there's often I think that's necessary for prose, and for poetry it's more interior, it's more introspective, and but I think that speaking of narrative earlier, like we talked about the idea of there being a spectrum within poetry, the poetry ecosystem, and certain types of poetry having more narrative than other types of poetry. And I feel that if there is a strong voice in a poem, then that is what gives it more narrative and more story than if it's stripped of voice, if it's more kind of like... I guess no poem is really stripped of voice, but there are some that have more voices than others. Yeah.
I think on that, like, you know, people talk about the 19th century novel as being polyphonic, which is to say it has lots of voices in it. So you know, you think about the big novels, you know, like the Russians and the French. There's like lots of people who are speaking. There's there's the soldier, and there's the like wife, and there's the mistress, and the footman, and there's the like lord, and there's the king, and that all these people are speaking. And it's not to say poetry can't do that, particularly epic poetry, but I do think poets think about voice, and it has a connection to orality and the ear that is distinct from prose more often, partly because we're reading it out loud more, and partly because the long roots of poetry. And it's like resilience and strength and like ongoing relationship connected back. So, you know, that's, I would hazard a guess that that's like a worldwide phenomena. Mm. You know, like Homer might be a couple of thousand years old, but they're still quite recent in the history of poetry. And I think there's something to be said for like orality and oral cultures, which engage with storytelling, but also engage in poetic modes.
Yeah, thanks for today. A question for both of you. I've just been intrigued by this idea of the aesthetic of the ecosystem, you know, and the actual construction and making of the experience. I just wondered whether both of you ever been surprised by the typography that's often brought to the word as well. So it's, you know, not taking away the beauty of the word or the prose, but it's actually that design of the word too.
Yeah.
I mean, can you speak of that? In simple terms, have you ever been surprised by the graphic design of your words?
Yeah, right. You don't mean the font, you mean like the actual...
Oh,
like,
it could be the font,
yeah.
It could be just the way that it's kind of split or...
I feel like that. I feel like that's especially important for concrete poetry. When I've written the occasional concrete poem, usually quite gimmicky, like a poem about a swan in the shape of a swan or something like that.
Yeah.
I think that that's when the... I feel like that's when the shaping of the letters and the typography plays an important part in the meaning of the poem and the way that it's read and the way that it's written. Because it can, the curve of an E would look a different way at the swan's beak than like the straight edge of an F, you know. So I think that I think that that's the only time for me when I pay attention to typography in poetry.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. One is that I have changed my default font on a number of occasions. So at the moment, I'm back in Times New Roman.
Yeah.
Previously to that, I was in Baskerville, and then I've been in Garamond before, and then I've been in Courier New. Like, that's a regrettable phase, I admit that publicly now. But I'm happy to confess to my Courier New stage as well. In terms of other moments too, I've done letterpress. So I've made books by hand, which involves thinking carefully about pagination, but also placing the blocks of each letter into a letterpress machine and doing it by hand, and like thinking about paper and ink and the density of that. So the design has been important. Also, the first poem I had published, which was in 2013, was an experimental concrete poem, and it was called In the Desert, and all it was a page filled with the closed bracket sign, because it kind of looked like the shape you get on sand dunes. Also looks like some sort of like central desert motifs and designs. But I also think poetry, precisely because it is contained in a way that a novel is not, allows you to emphasize things like graphic design, to think about page sizing and typography. And if you look at the poetry ecosystem, books of poetry seem to have far greater diversity than books of prose, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is my book of poems, and it'd be hard to find a novel this size. But it's not that uncommon for poets. And you go to a Collective Works in Melbourne, which is, you know, a great poetry bookstore, and there's books that are fat, skinny, small, big, with Courier New or Baskerville or Times New Roman. It's quite a space that is the research and development wing of language, which allows you to experiment with things like graphic design.
Mm-hmm.
I think your question is also interesting because it's dependent on the language as well. So if we were reading poetry in Chinese or Japanese, I feel that because they're pictograph kind of like scripts, what they look like is so much more important than what the Roman letters look like.
Can I just add though?
Yeah.
Particularly on from this idea of like it having a kind of musicality, I was thinking a lot about Kathy Acker and like her kind of experimental texts like Great Expectations or whatever from like the 80s and 90s, this kind of like real punk kind of rocker thing. And the line break is interesting, or the lack of a line break, because I think she's using the like technique or form of prose poetry to kind of really rupture expectation, or it's like a really disjointed read, and it kind of skips between prose and narrative, prose poetry and narrative end kind of lined poetry forms, and it's something to think about.
I think in that way, like, I don't think myself, or, and I don't want to speak on behalf of any other poet, it's like we're not giving up the line break anytime soon either. And I think it's yet another useful technique and tool to have at your disposal. And for me, what I particularly appreciate about poetry is that it gives you lots of tools to play with in a kind of it's quite open, which is not to dismiss the like importance of formal strictures or like writing really well crafted, contained, technically precise, but I'm saying like poetry in its broadest way, including prose poetry, is a way of engaging with language that is full of possibility. Do you have anything to add?
No, I think
All right,
that's a good note to end on, actually.
We'll end on your comparison with Yeats. So thanks everyone, and hopefully stick around and have a drink and join us in the next session.